Senate Agriculture and Veteran Committee will come to order. We'll pick up right away Senate File 350, Senator Sparks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the opportunity to testify on Senate File 350. I do have a small oral amendment, Mr. Chair, if it's okay with you, that we'd like to make that would get the bill in the shape the author would prefer. That would be on line 1.9, after the word A, strike day off with pay and insert personal day of leave qualification.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sparks, could you say that again, please?
On line 1.9, after the word A.
The second A or the first one?
The second one, I'm sorry. Strike day off with pay and then insert personal day of leave qualification.
Mr. Chair.
Let's go again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Sparks, why the change, or was there a problem with?
Mr. Chair and members in the House, it was brought to the attention. I believe the School Boards Association testified that this would make the bill cost neutral with no fiscal cost if we insert this, and so that those members would be able to use a personal day in that instance.
Thank you.
Senator Hamm.
Well, maybe we should adopt the amendment. I guess I'll ask a
Senator
question.
Senator Hamm, I'm looking for somebody to offer it because Senator Sparks can't.
Oh, well, I'll offer the amendment
oral amendment on line 1.9 to after a day off from personal leave day. Is that what you said?
Yeah, personal
day of leave.
Leave qualification.
Okay. Does everybody understand that? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So adopted. Now your bill should be in order, Senator Sparks.
Perfect. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I know that this committee has done a lot of great work supporting our veterans over the years and certainly this year. And to that end, that's why we bring this proposal forward with you today. My grandfather was one of the last surviving members of World War I, and he taught me a lot about the importance of veterans. I think that it's very important that we continue to do that. And so what this bill would do is, under present state laws, if a district has school on Martin Luther King Day, they must have a program in tribute to him. And it was certainly my belief, and hopefully the members of the committee would agree, that if school is held on Veterans Day, I think that veterans should be treated the same way. We also go on to talk about providing a day off. The oral amendment that we offered is a compromise in that regard. And we further go on to either encourage private employers to do the same thing to tribute and pay tribute to our veterans. With me today, Mr. Chair, I know that you have a busy schedule, is Norm Hekimovich from the City of Austin. He's been very active in many of the school programs that we have locally, and I thought that I'd let him share a few of his experiences with the committee today.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
My name is Norman E. Hekimovich, past commander of VFW, American Legion, and DAV, and a retired principal. I think it's so important, and I think it's long, long overdue. You know, in the state of Minnesota especially, you're talking about that we have somewhere around 460,000 veterans in the state of Minnesota, which is 9-plus of the percent of the population. And we do not honor these people as we should. You know, the federal government, in their infinite wisdom, makes all of them on Monday so that it's a three-day holiday so people can take a holiday instead of honoring those who made the supreme sacrifice like Memorial Day. Veterans Day goes back to 1918 on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month in 1918. Armistice Day was signed. In 1954, they changed it to Veterans Day to honor all veterans. But many times we forget about that. In my school, we always honored Veterans Day. In Austin, we honor Veterans Day. But a prime example, last year we had Veterans Day and it was on a Saturday. And it was our sesquicentennial. We had less than 200 people show up for a Veterans Day ceremony. You know, it's sad that we take for granted all those people who have put their lives on the line for us. There are 27 million veterans in the United States. And we're sending, as I came up today, listening that 300 more people from Black Hawk units going over to Afghanistan or Iraq or wherever they're going. These are veterans. If they aren't, they will be. And I think it's so important that we honor these people with time, and schools should be honoring these people. It's a disgrace, actually, when we don't. We have the freedom to sit in this chambers because of those people who have sacrificed their life. You take back in World War II. Had we lost World War II, we'd be either speaking Chinese or Japanese, or we'd been speaking German, right in these chambers. And Hitler had a plan for us. It was in 1942 as an American Legion. So I think it's very important that we take these things and that we make it a requirement that people honor these days and that kids know what veterans are. And all veterans. See, I don't always believe that we say a veteran is only those that served in combat. No. Everybody who ever served this country is a veteran. They served when they had to serve and did the job that they had to do. And I think it's very, very important that we honor all those. And I don't think we should discriminate between a combat veteran and a regular veteran. I don't think so. Because there takes six people to support every one person in combat. So we need people to train. We need people to do every other job. So a veteran is a veteran, somebody who served this country honorably. Thank you.
Any questions from the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Sparks, just possibly a technical correction. When we've been getting bills up that do regard veterans, oftentimes we've been referring to statute, the definition of veteran. I mean, you're talking about a veteran as a combat or anybody who served, or exactly what do we mean by veteran? And we've been adding anyone who is a veteran as defined by in some of the statutes, and I'm wondering if that would be wise in this one as well.
Senate Consul, can you help us some way?
Mr. Chairman and members, I think I'll just double check this. I think the existing definition in law already applies to this section.
Okay.
Just because of the way it's written. Mr. Knopf actually has that section of statutes available right now.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, Senator Lurie, the way this definition works is it's supposed to be encompassing in all the statutes. In fact, what it says is the word veteran is used in Minnesota statutes, except in sections, and it lists several higher education, it looks like, and I'm not sure about some of the other references, means a citizen of the United States. So basically, this definition applies whenever you use it in statutes. Sometimes, just to let people know, we'll put a cross-reference in, even though it does apply broadly like that. In this situation, you're amending the same chapter of law, so it probably isn't necessary to do that. But if you're amending another chapter of law, even though this applies, sometimes it's nice to provide that cross-reference.
Good enough. Thank you.
Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just a question. Is this bill going to the Education Committee after? And the only reason I'm asking, Mr. Chairman, is I'm the language on line 1.13 referring to the amount of time that must be spent to do this, I'm not sure that that's quite the right way we want to say this. I think that there are different ways that schools deal with the periods in the day, and there may be another way to structure this, although that may not be appropriate to try to take that up in this committee. But if it's going to the Education Committee, we can do it there.
Well, Senator Hand, as the bill leaves here, it'll go to the Education Committee, and then they can work out the finer details. Any other discussion? Senator Cooley?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess related to what Senator Hand said, I mean, the way I'm reading it, that provision could be met by having an all-school assembly, you know, where you had a speaker or, you know, where you had a program that lasted for about 30 minutes. Isn't that correct? Or,
mm-hmm.
Senator Kubley, would you like to change it here or send it on to the education?
Well, I think it's fine the way it is, Mr. Chair. I think Senator Sparks is nodding his assent, and I believe his witness said so as well. So I think it's adequate the way it is, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any other discussion? Senator Engelbretson?
Just one question, Senator. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just reading it here, does it give the school a choice? Either grant the day off, and if they're not going to take the day off, then they're supposed to have the instruction. I'm sorry.
We did an amendment.
Oh, you did an amendment. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. That's what happens when you're late. I'm sorry. I apologize.
Thank you. That's fine.
Senator Sparks, you can answer that.
No, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in front of the committee today.
Are you looking for a motion, Mr. Chair?
If there are no more questions, I'm certainly looking for a motion.
I'd move that Senate file 350 be recommended to pass and referred to the Education Policy Committee.
Senator Scoy moves that Senate File 350, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Education Committee. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? So adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you.
Senator Kubley, are you ready?
Because I'm late for one meeting and I get behind.
What they did.
Picked up on that right away.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 375 is—it's a rather simple a bill. Initially, I was told that this would not have a fiscal note. There is a small fiscal note now that is included with the bill, Mr. Chair and members. But basically, what the bill does is it changes the definition of who is eligible for to attend a state institution without paying the tuition. They would have to be, you know, we already have it in statute, is my understanding, that the children of deceased veterans can attend a state college or university tuition-free, but this would extend that benefit to their spouses as well. And there's, you know, Mike, I have trouble with his last name, but he probably has trouble with mine, too. I don't know. But we have a member from the department here anyway, Mr. Chair, and he'd like to say a few words.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. Mike Puglisi, Deputy Commissioner, Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs.
You might want to ask him to spell his last name, Mr. Chair.
P-U-G-L-I-E-S-E. As Senator Kubley stated, you know, basically what this bill does is it clarifies and also slightly extends the eligibility for the War Orphans Act of 1943, and it also retitles the statute as the War Survivors Act. So it broadens it slightly by allowing not just the orphans, but the surviving spouses of deceased veterans from taking advantage of this benefit.
Members have any questions? Members, I'll make a brief statement. We're supposed to be done with finance bills when we wrap up our, but it's some unknown factor come in here that is, I call this an emergency because we didn't know there was a financial part. And it will go to finance and they'll have to figure out what it is. That's the only reason that we're doing it. Otherwise, we shouldn't be doing that.
Mr. Chairman and members, on that point, there is a fiscal note on this, and I haven't handed it out, but there's a small cost, Veteran Affairs, it's $26,000 per year, although they noted in the text of the fiscal note that they may be able to absorb that, but it would maybe reprioritize some of their efforts under the, I believe it's the State Soldiers Assistance Program. The other cost is $40,000 per year that would be from MNSCU. So the costs are relatively small, but we still should probably send this to finance and let them refer it over to the Higher Ed Committee and to make sure that they're able to either absorb these costs or make a separate appropriation maybe in the Finance Committee for this bill.
Well, that's why I'm going to suggest this goes to Finance Committee and they can figure that part out. Any other questions? Senator Kubley?
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. If there are no further questions, I would recommend that Senate File 375 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Finance Committee.
Senator Coobley moves that Senate File 375 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Finance Committee. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? So adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Welcome, Senator Vickerman, Colonel Ullis.
Madam Chair, Senate File 590 is a resolution, and it's exhorting Congress to reform the federal Montgomery GI Bill for the Selective Reserves to permit members of the National Guard and Reserves who have been mobilized into federal active duty in support of current wars to receive and use their federal education benefits following separation from an active reserve status and final discharge from the military. Members, I won't go through the rest of the page, but on the back, look on page 2, line 216 is kind of what is what the meat of this bill is. And it says, be it resolved by the legislature of the state of Minnesota that it strongly and urgently demands that the Congress and President move with all haste to reform MGIB-SR program to permit members of the National Guard and other military reserves who have served in active military duty to use their promised educational benefits following military service. Irrespective of whether or not these patriotic citizen soldiers choose to reenlist in the National Guard or Reserves. Madam Chair, I have all us here, but run through some of the bill, and then I'll try to answer some of the questions if I can.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Colonel Eric Allness, Department of Military Affairs. And just a few comments. Prior to 9/11, the current programs really made sense. What it was is it was a retention program. It was a way for us to help retain members in the Selective Reserve and have them continue their membership while they're getting their civilian education. However, since 9/11, the high deployment or tempo, or the amount of times that members of the reserve component have to deploy, for many of these now combat veterans, it's not been possible for them to complete their college education. And when they complete their tour of duty, their enlistment requirement, they've gone off to pursue their civilian career and education. And unfortunately, they're not able to get their civilian education paid for because the GI Bill is aimed at keeping them in the service, even though they completed their service honorably. I'd like to point out that the state resolved this for the National Guard during the last legislative session by changing the state tuition reimbursement program. So members of the Guard, they have an extension of 2 years plus a month-by-month extension to get their college once they get back. So that way, members of the Guard have been taken care of by the state. Unfortunately, the federal government has not done it for members of the Reserve or Guard who are taking advantage of that program. I stand by to answer any technical questions.
Thank you, Colonel. Members, any questions? Hearing none, Senator, would you like to make a motion?
Madam Chair, if there's no questions, I would move that Senate File 590 be referred to, and it goes to the floor. Where does it go to the floor?
Rules Committee. Rules Committee.
Oh, Rules Committee, that's right. The Rules Committee and members, I'm just about positive this will pass when I get it to the floor. And I only say that because this is a veterans-friendly committee. If we can't get it out of here, then we're going to have a tough time getting it out of something else. So we're just trying to do every little bit we can to help those that I'll say this. Those that helped me be here and sit in front of them. Because without them, we couldn't be here. So it's just another little token. I'm not crazy about resolutions, but this one I think we can send to big government even, and I think they'll be with us. So I would make that motion.
Thank you, Senator. Any other discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Check.
Senator Erickson Ropes, what's the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm here today with a bill that has to do with the Veterans Board and their executive director provisions. We've made some changes because they're looking for a new executive director and members of the board, and there had been some stipulations in there related to veteran status. And they're finding it difficult to find qualified candidates who are veterans and qualified to take the position. So we made some minor adjustments, and that's the bill before you. It has one paragraph here that we've amended, and I think we'll let any technical questions or any more background material be handled by...
Welcome to the committee.
State
your name
for
the
record.
Mr. Williams. Good evening, Mr. Chair, committee members, Senator. I'm Dan Williams, Vice Chair of the Minnesota Veterans Home Board. The bill, as Senator Erickson Ropes explained, we believe that we need to change the legislation at this point. We've been searching for a new executive director within the organization since August of last year. And we do have a hard constraint that that executive director must be a veteran. And certainly as we've been faced with a number of challenges, the pool has been narrowed for two reasons. The veterans piece is one, and then the compensation. And we believe that if we expand it, our objective is to always look for a veteran first. We'd love to have a veteran there. And when we find that that is problematic, to open it up where non-veterans can apply. Also in this bill, it also states that the chair of the board be a veteran. As it exists today, every board member happens to be a veteran now. But if we don't make that change, then we could have a non-veteran being the chair of the board as well. And then it also cleans up some things with the ex officio members not having veteran status. With that, I'd stand for any additional questions that I may be able to answer.
Any questions? Senator Erickson Ropes, what you're really the main part of this, we're changing this person does not have to be a veteran in order to serve. Is that right?
That's correct, Senator. In order to be hired, the preference would be for candidates who are veterans. And if they're not able to find a qualified candidate who is a veteran, then they would be able to look at candidates who are non-veterans.
Senator Ropes, you know the trouble we've had at the VA hospital and other places. There are some excellent people that could help us with some of these issues. But the law reads right now they have to be a veteran, and that's hard to find. They've been looking and looking to find somebody. But this simply changes it so that if he's qualified, he can be a member of the board. Am I right?
Yes.
And, you know, that's a kind of a funny thing. I'm an ex-officio member, too. I got to looking at the law, and I really can't even be there because I'm not a veteran.
Well, Senator, this will make you legal.
Mr. Bottom?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Ropes, I have a question that is a little bit technical in nature, and I'm not sure. This just occurred to me. If you look on page 1, line 15, that clause 3 says at least 5 members experienced in policy formulation, so there could be some intention to allow the appointment of more than 5 members there. And when you look up on line 1.8, that language says the board consists of 9 voting members appointed by the governor. So I guess the question would be if there's an intention to allow the governor to appoint more than 5 members under clause 3, I think you'd need to put at least before 9 on line 1.8 in order to conform the two. But maybe there's another idea there that...
Yes, Senator, committee members, the this is not to expand the number of appointments by the governor. That would remain nine. But this would also allow us to really look at having board members, in addition to a heart for veterans, to have some skill set or experience in the policy, health care delivery system. So it's putting a more relevant skill set on the board as well.
Lynn, Mr. Williams, you're happy with this if we leave it just the way it is?
We are, but...
Mr. Chairman, I think on line 1.15, you might eliminate any confusion if you delete the new language there, the at least. Then it's clear that, the way it sits right now, five members would have to have that experience. I don't know if there's an intention to allow the other appointments to have some of that experience. It might need to be worded differently. But if you leave it the way it is now, I think it's ambiguous.
Mr. Chair, I believe, Mr. Williams, wouldn't it be that all nine could have that experience? Isn't that what your intent is here?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scogin, that is correct.
So if we took out at least, wouldn't that
each
part would go away then?
Mr. Chairman, that's, I guess, one interpretation. I haven't had time to think about how you could word this otherwise. It's the way it's worded there and positioned next to the numbering for the clause, it really looks like there's an intention or... there's some ambiguity about the number of members
Mr. Botter,
under that clause.
In line 1.8, if we said the board consists of no more than nine, or would that no? Then they could go smaller than that, couldn't they?
Where's this going, the floor?
Oh. Mr. Chair.
Senator Wiggins.
Mr. Bodern, it took me a while to catch on. You have on number one a chair, number two, three public members, and number three then was five, which makes up the nine. So if you're saying at least five, you're suggesting that there could be more members to the board than nine. However, I think what Senator Erickson Ropes is getting at least five of the nine, which could include the three public members or the chair. In other words, it doesn't specifically have to be these more than five in Category 3, but Categories 2 and 1 could have that same experience. But I think you're right. I think it makes it very ambiguous and difficult to interpret. It might be best, Senator Ropes, if your intention is to have five, to just leave out the at least, and the other ones still could have that expertise but don't have to have.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Wiggins, I think you're right. I don't think there would be anything prohibiting the other members under Clauses 1 and 2 having that experience. But if you leave Clause 3 without the new language, you'd have at a minimum five and nothing prohibiting the others from having that additional experience. I guess I don't know that I have an answer right now for another way you could amend this. Maybe given a little bit of time, I could prepare something for subsequent discussion of the bill.
Mr. Bonham, how long would that take you?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Knopf has put his mind to work here.
Members, let's just set this aside a minute because it's going straight to the floor, so I would sooner have it. So we at least understand it are coming out of our committee. Then we'll come right back to it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Chairman, I think though, if I'm understanding what you're trying to do, would be to be on line 1.12 after the semicolon, insert and on line 1.13, strike three and insert eight. Delete everything after delivery on 1.14 and insert a period, and on 1.15, delete paren three paren and insert and then just make it capital A. So it would be a new paragraph. So basically you're saying a chair and then eight public members experience in policy formulation, and then you say at least five members must, and then the after on line 1.15, after members insert must be.
Mr. Knopf, that works for us.
Senator Lurie.
I think you're, if I could maybe help a little bit here, I think you'd rather on line 1.5, rather than after members inserting language, just cross out experienced in public policy formation with professional experience in healthcare delivery, which has already been said. It would instead say at least 5 members who are members of congressionally chartered veterans organizations, which is the additional criteria. So there's 8 members with this public policy and professional experience, at least 5 of whom are members of the vets organizations. I think that's what we're trying to get at, right?
Right. Yeah, Mr. Chairman, and I think Senator Lurie, that's a good fix. And I think if you do what I was talking about earlier, but just delete experienced in policy formulation with professional experience in health care delivery who are, and just say at least 5 public members must be members of congressionally chartered veterans organizations. So maybe if I could reread.
I'm going to have you do that.
the amendment. Mr. Chairman, on page 1.12, line 1.12, after the semicolon, insert and. 1.13, strike 3 and insert 8. 1.14, delete everything after delivery and insert a period. On line 1.15, strike the 3 paren, and then delete experience in policy formulation, or delete everything after members, and delete everything on line 1.15, and then delete everything before of on 1.16, and insert must be.
Mm-hmm. Members understand it?
Yes. Mr. Knopf, the question is on 1.16. We want at least 5 members who must be members of congressionally chartered.
Oh, okay. Mr. Chairman, Senator, I see. So I guess I did a little too far on the striking. On 1.16, then before you would strike everything before members, mm-hmm. and insert must be.
Yes.
That would be it would read better that way, yes.
Thank you. Mr.
Robes, you'd like to incorporate that into your bill?
Yes, I would, please.
Okay, so everybody understand the amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So adopted. Any more on the bill? Not Senator Erickson Robes. What do you want to do with your bill?
I would appreciate moving this bill 2059 as amended to pass, and I'm not sure where it goes from here.
I've just been informed it has to go to state and local government.
State and local government. Thank you.
Erickson Ropes moves that Senate file 2059 as amended be recommended pass and be referred to state and local government operations. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? So adopted.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Did you forget the 15?
Senator Ropes, you have another bill.
Yes.
Yeah, they're all done.
Okay, good catch.
Mr. Chair and committee members, we're passing out a executive summary here. I'm happy to be before the committee again this afternoon with Senate File 1397. It has to do with depleted uranium exposure. And I'm joined here today with David Francis, Tom Bottolini, and Nancy Gertner. And you have the bill before you. I would just like to introduce that and then turn over any questions, technical questions, to my testifiers.
Who wants to tell us a little bit about the bill? Welcome to the committee and state your name for the record.
Okay. Good afternoon. David Francis. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, guests, and fellow veterans, thank you for this invitation to speak. My name is David Francis, a resident of Stillwater and a 30-year veteran of the United States Navy. I had the privilege of advancing from seaman to Navy captain in a mere 25 years. During my career, I served aboard several nuclear submarines and was responsible for nuclear weapons. I can pronounce nuclear. Fortunately, the nuclear radiation aboard ship was contained in the reactor and inside the warheads. However, we were constantly monitored for exposure. I always carried a dosimeter on my belt. I am also a chemist and a former 3M engineer. And what I learned over my many years of possible exposure to nuclear and chemical radiation and contamination is, when in doubt, monitor and test. When in doubt, test. I'm here today to encourage you to legislate and to fund testing for our returning Minnesota Guard and Reserve for exposure to depleted uranium. Depleted uranium, which is contained in armor-piercing munitions, has been documented to cause birth defects in the offspring of soldiers and civilians, and multiple health problems such as chronic fatigue, leukemia, cancer, kidney problems, respiratory problems, neurological problems, cognitive difficulties, and death. In my opinion, exposure to depleted uranium may well be the Agent Orange of the Iraqi wars. When we send our men and women into war, into dangerous and toxic environments, we have a sacred obligation to provide the best possible health care for them when they come home. When in doubt, test. Our governor and this legislature are showing leadership and courage by putting the programs and budgets in place to care for the thousands of returning Minnesota veterans. You have a tough task. You are responsible for doing what's right for our veterans in the face of many conflicting and other demands for our limited resources. Thank you for serving. I would encourage you to do the following. Do not rely on the federal government or the Department of Defense. They're lagging behind on this issue of radiation, heavy metal poisoning from depleted uranium. As a Vietnam veteran, I know that the federal government has a long history of failing our veterans. Keep in mind what happened with Agent Orange, their continual denial and lack of recognition of the health risks to our Vietnam veterans. Please do not balance the budget on the backs of our veterans. And don't wait for scientific certainty. There are conflicting medical reports out there and inconsistent and incomplete. Do not wait for scientific certainty. The health risk of Agent Orange and secondhand smoke were ignored far too long, and people died. When in doubt, test. put the care of our returning veterans at the top of our state priority list. Continue to show your leadership on veterans' health care. They are, after all, our own men and women, our Minnesota Guard and Reserve. We are responsible for their care. Move this bill forward and fund responsible testing and protection for our Minnesota veterans. They are returning this year. This is the time to act. We will not get a second chance. Thank you. I stand by for questions.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Bottolene, and I live in Red Wing, Minnesota. In 1970, I enlisted in the Minnesota National Guard, and in 1976, I had only advanced to a sergeant, but received an honorable discharge at that time. During those 6 years, I came to appreciate the camaraderie that develops between members in the service, and at the same time, came to kind of understand how the military and the Army worked. I am neither a scientist nor a medical doctor, but just like each and every one of you on this committee, I feel I am able to do credible research, to analyze that research, and then come to reasonable conclusions. I have been looking into the issue of depleted uranium used in munitions since 1996. I have the task here of kind of educating you a little bit about uranium, depleted uranium, why it's used in munitions, the test that the VA currently offers to returning soldiers, and the best practice test that we are requesting. If we remember back from high school science, we remember that uranium is a heavy metal, just like mercury and lead. In Minnesota, we test fish for heavy metal mercury poisoning, not because we want to protect the fish, but because we're concerned about humans getting this heavy metal inside our bodies. Uranium is one of the most common elements on Earth. If you were to dig down 1 foot in a square mile, the yield of uranium would be approximately 4 tons. And believe it or not, just about everyone in this room would test positive for uranium if we were to take the test that's offered to the soldiers. Uranium is also made up primarily of three distinct isotopes, U-238, U-235, and U-234. It becomes depleted uranium because they enrich the uranium is what it's called. And what they actually do is they take the U-235 and the U-234 out of the uranium, and they use that to make nuclear reactor rods and the fissionable material and nuclear bombs. And what's left over, about 99.7% of the product, is U-238, and it's referred to as depleted uranium. It remains a heavy metal. It has a half-life of 4.5 billion years. It's 60% as radioactive as natural uranium, and it's primarily an alpha emitter. It's also safe if it's not ingested or inhaled into your body. A DU munition, they use depleted uranium because, quite frankly, it's extremely effective. A 120-millimeter tank shell contains 10.8 pounds of solid depleted uranium. When the munition is fired, primarily it's just the depleted uranium bar that is going through the air and strikes the target. And because of its pyrotechnic nature, it actually starts burning while it's still in flight. As it hits the metal or its target, just like butter, it literally burns right through it. There's no nuclear explosion, and there's actually no explosion whatsoever. Any subsequent explosion is any munitions that are inside that tank. But as it's burning through the tank, it reaches to between 2,000 and 3,000 degrees. And 70% of that 10.8-pound penetrator is aerosolized into uranium oxide dust. And because of these high temperatures, Some of that dust is actually crystallized. It becomes a ceramicized uranium oxide microscopic dust. In that that one shell, the yield, 70%, would be about 7 pounds of this uranium oxide dust. The military, through their own studies, says that all this dust then settles to the ground within 7 to 10 meters of the target that it struck. I'm not sure whether or not you've ever seen any pictures of the horrific weather storms that they have in Iraq. They don't have tornadoes. They don't have tsunamis. They don't have hurricanes. They have dust storms, huge dust storms. A whole wall of dust will come and actually blacken out the sun, and this can last for days. Now remember, the military says that this stuff isn't bad unless you inhale it or you ingest it. And it's real safe because it falls right to the ground because it's a heavy metal. If you've ever seen pictures of these dust storms, you would truly question how this 7 pounds of dust stays on the ground as one of these storms comes through. Testing. If you or I were tested for uranium, we'd probably test positive. And there's actually a safe scale. Because there's so much of it all around you, everybody tests positive for it. You're taking it in every day, and for the most part, you're flushing it out through your urine. If you're a soldier and you feel that you were exposed to depleted uranium, the VA would give you this test. And even if you were contaminated with depleted uranium, it wouldn't show up in this test. You would more than likely still fall within the acceptable range. What we're asking for is that a best practice test by mass plasma spectrometry be offered to the soldiers. And what this does is it actually isolates the individual isotopes of the uranium in your urine. Now, once again, we know what naturally occurring uranium is made up of. And if those numbers are off at all, then that means that you have heavy metal toxicity, that your body is retaining the Du-238, depleted uranium. The test that we're asking for is extremely accurate. It's very sophisticated. The British government agency that's charged with testing, or that was charged with looking into depleted uranium poisoning for British soldiers about a month and a half ago, chose this test to test their soldiers. And then finally, in November of 1995, Life magazine did an investigation on a recent report issued by the federal government that clearly stated that the Department of Defense had inadequately prepared soldiers for the use and the dangers surrounding depleted uranium. On the cover of that issue was the picture of a Sergeant Paul Hansen, and he was holding his 3-year-old son, JC. And JC was born with no arms and with no legs. I wonder whether or not Sergeant Paul Hansen would have chosen to have children if he had known that his semen was contaminated with depleted uranium. He had that right to know. Our soldiers coming back who have unexplained headaches, chronic fatigue, sore joints, unexplained cancers, they have a right to know. And we have an obligation to provide them with that knowledge. You can show your support for the health of our troops, your appreciation, and your gratitude by supporting this bill. But more importantly, you will be offering those soldiers the comfort of knowing. I believe it's our turn to protect the guard. Thank you.
Another witness, Senator Robes.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Nancy Gertner. I live in St. Louis Park, and I'm a Navy veteran. I'm here today because I believe that we, the people, need to be doing more to help the military veterans with health care issues. As a citizen and a military veteran, I am concerned that the federal government is not fulfilling their obligation to members of the uniformed services. I believe military personnel should be tested for exposure to depleted uranium, just like we test preschoolers for exposure to lead before they start school. I believe the state of Minnesota should provide for testing of military personnel that served in areas where they may have been exposed to depleted uranium. Because National Guard members only have an entitlement to 2 years of health care through the Federal Department of Veterans Affairs after they return from their deployment, they may be in a position to be denied medical care if they have symptoms that manifest after their 24 months that they've returned from deployment. Bills currently in the 110th Congress could extend the period of entitlement from the current 2 years to a 5-year period. A legal precedent regarding exposure to depleted uranium was set recently by members of the New York National Guard. Several members were sick and experiencing symptoms, and they didn't have an explanation for them. And the New York Daily News paid for these soldiers to be tested, and their urine samples were processed at a laboratory in Germany. When the results came back positive, it gave the veterans a reason for the many symptoms that they were experiencing. And they were then able to get treatment through the Department of Veterans Affairs. Some of us have been putting money together for a fund to have a Minnesota veteran tested for exposure to depleted uranium. Our veteran was with us and provided testimony when we had House committees, but unfortunately he is not able to be here with us today because he is in a medical treatment program and he is out of state. He was invited to participate in a medical surveillance program. It's a government-sponsored program in Baltimore, Maryland. And he believes he was invited to participate in this surveillance program because he was involved in a friendly fire incident in Gulf War I. He was in close proximity to a piece of Army hardware that was hit by a piece of U.S. munition, and he believes that he inhaled depleted uranium. He has been treated for lymphoma, and he says that he suffers from 30 different medical conditions, and in order to treat the symptoms, he takes 15 to 18 medications daily. He believes the friendly fire incident caused him to get the depleted uranium poisoning, and he thinks that this incident changed his life. He is no longer able to remain on active duty, even though he loved the Army and was very dedicated to it. And now that he is back in civilian life, he remains very dedicated to veterans as a member of a veteran service organization and works to provide honors through funeral details. He's also concerned not only for his own health, but for the health of his two young children that were born following his deployment overseas. The Baltimore, Maryland study does not include the offspring of soldiers. Every year, the Department of Veterans Affairs sends an annual report to Congress on Gulf War veterans' illnesses. The Army has not identified depleted uranium or anything else as a cause of Gulf War illnesses for the military veterans that participate in the government-sponsored program. Thank you.
Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is your desire to be tested because there's a real treatment available or just for the soldier's ability to know? Is there real treatment once they're found to have DU?
There's remediation. There is treatment. The first critical part, Senator, is so they know and can make informed reproductive decisions and seek medical treatment.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair. And just I see in the bill's appropriation there's $3 million. In your letter,
Mr. Francis, you were looking for $1 million a year.
The funding from the House, House File 1065, funded $1 million. So that's in their omnibus bill.
Thank you.
Senator Dale.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, and perhaps some of the witnesses can answer this. What are there some health care professionals or organizations of health care professionals that are supporting this legislation, or what is the view of the health care professionals that are working with veterans right now?
There actually is a from the Minnesota VA here. Perhaps he would like to say a word on it. The federal government VA, once again, is following the line of the Department of Defense, saying that this is not a problem, and we've tested a multitude of soldiers who have had these complaints, and not a single one. Anyways, at last year at this time, there had not been a single soldier that had been confirmed with depleted uranium. Once again, they're not offering the test that actually looks for exposure and the heavy metal toxicity from the depleted uranium.
Yes. Well, Mr. Chairman, what I'm wondering about is why aren't they? If you know, we have a nurse who is the chief author of this bill, and it'd be nice to know what the professional health care providers in the VA and in the nation and the researchers and so forth, what do they say about this? Is this a good expenditure of $3 million, or isn't it? And if it is, why aren't they already doing it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dill, I've brought bills before this committee before. It was pretty easy bills. This is a very complicated bill. And I think you have some very good questions. It's a whole concept that this nation is struggling with. What is depleted uranium? What effect is it having on our soldiers? Who's dealing with it? And what sort of efforts are we making as citizens and as legislatures to address a potential toxic hazard to our returning vets? And as we experienced during the Vietnam War, in the gap between conclusive evidence, a lot of nothing gets done. And so I think this bill brings to you a challenge to start considering and thinking about how we as a state might be dealing with that. I'm not familiar, Senator Dale, specifically if what the positions of medical organizations are, like Minnesota Nurses Association or the Minnesota Medical Association, that sort of thing. And I think everyone is caught in that middle ground again right now. So what I bring to you in this bill is really a moral dilemma. We've seen the lack of preparedness on a federal level in dealing with our returning veterans. Just this weekend, it's just a little off topic, but I think reflects on the larger problem. This last weekend in Winona, I was part of a recognition for a local soldier who had been injured in Iraq and had a very traumatic brain injury. And he's been recovering for a couple of years now, multiple surgeries. But the number of problems he's going through in terms of getting the support he needs from the federal government and through the federal VA system, not the state veterans organizations, is just mind-boggling. We as a nation seem to have committed to going off to war without a plan at all on how to take care of our veterans once they return. And I think this committee has dealt with that issue in terms of many other bills. So the question for us is, if the federal government is not doing something about it, shall we also do nothing about it?
Follow-up, Senator Dale.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, I'm very disappointed in the performance of the federal government and how they've taken care of our veterans, especially the wounded veterans, as they returned home, and I'm very troubled by that. But I'm also, you know, wondering for those that are into the medical research and in the treatment of a problem like this, what does the research say that we can reasonably do in terms of treatment and detection? And is this, you know, just, it seems to me I need more information before I can decide whether or not I want to spend $3 million. Now, I did notice that Mr. Tom Bottolene.
Correct, Senator.
I think you mentioned that there were 4 tons of uranium in the first 1 foot of soil all over the place.
Square mile.
In a square mile, okay. So you get 4 tons in a square mile. So that's not a lot, because I think there's 2 million pounds of dirt per acre going down 6 inches. So I can do the arithmetic. It sounds like a lot of uranium, and it probably is, but it's not really that much, but it's quite a bit. And so that means we're all exposed, as you said. And Senator Langseth here, and he and I mess around with the dirt. I guess there's 4 of us in a row here that deal with dirt, produce crops. And I don't know if it's an issue for those of us that are farmers or not, but it would be helpful to me, if we're going to do this, if there was a healthcare professional who's been working in this area that could advocate for this.
Yes, sir.
So there's a little missing testimony here.
Yes, sir, Senator. I understand. Maybe I can add some perspective. What we're proposing is a test, and the tests that are currently being used test for naturally occurring uranium. The healthcare professionals and the veterans is not using the best practice test that detects toxic metal poisoning from depleted uranium, U-238. So I believe that's the first step, is test, see how widespread it is, create awareness. The remediation is fairly straightforward. It's chelation to attach chemicals to the heavy metal, to the uranium oxide, and help flush it out of the body. So I think test, raise awareness, and get the medical professionals to start working on the protocol. Once we identify the extent of the problem and veterans come forward, what's happening now is returning veterans, when they're given the opportunity for medical tests, they say, no, thank you, I want to go home. I want a reunion with my wife and children and my family. I'll go to the doctor later. So not only isn't the right test being used or available, but they're not stepping forward. So testing is the key part of this initiative.
Senator Worgen.
Thank you. Just a question. You mentioned chelation is the way to deal with the problem if it is identified. Chelation is not a widely accepted practice in the medical community, and I don't know that it's covered by any insurance anywhere. Do you have different information than that?
I'm not a medical professional. The research that I've done is it's similar to the treatment of leukemia in children. It's a similar protocol. But I do have a nurse right here.
I believe Senator Gimsey, you were next.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Can you tell me how many other states are currently have a law like this or are doing this type of activity, this type of testing?
I believe none.
Two other tests have passed legislation mandating that the testing be offered to their returning soldiers. Both those states did not fund the legislation, though. So it was pretty meaningless.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gimsey, I would like to offer, I think the Minnesota legislature has the opportunity here to be a leader and be the first state to provide an appropriation to do the testing for their soldiers.
Senator Dale.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Erickson Ropes, could you give me the name of 1 or 2 or 3 physicians somewhere in the world that would endorse this bill?
I've not contacted, sir, any physicians about this. I think we do need to have continuing conversation about this. I agree. There's this huge medical question, and even within the world community, there's a lot of debate about whether what depleted uranium is, what effect it has on people. But we all know there is such a thing called Gulf War Syndrome, and I think that's where a lot of people in the community believe there's a link between Gulf War Syndrome and the illnesses coming out of that exposure and depleted uranium. And I guess the point is there's many people believe this is a chicken or the egg scenario here. We're never going to know what problems we have unless we do the testing. And we'll never do the testing for some people unless we know exactly that there's definitive proof between the cause and effect. So someone's at some point has to make a decision to either do the testing and identify a problem, or do the testing and say there is no problem, or not do testing at all. And to this point, we've just been looking at not testing. And I think one of the things that's interesting in this proposal is that they're talking about best practices, health screening, and a bioassay. I think Mr. Bottolini spoke specifically about one kind of test. But when you leave the testing in a broad category, such as the bill does with best practice health screening, it allows you to use whatever is available at the time that would be able to determine the cause and effect. It's a quantitative and qualitative study that measures levels of organisms in living tissue. So it's a beginning point. I'm not certain if this committee is comfortable in taking that on, but I certainly think if you're interested, we could pull in other medical people to testify, probably on both sides of the issue. And we would probably, since none of us here are chemists or physicians that I'm aware of, be just as confused at the end of all the testimony as we are oftentimes and called upon to make a decision. But saying that, Mike Pluglisi from the Department of Veterans Affairs is here, and he does have a comment.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Dill, I have the name and phone number of a physician in California that has worked at Navy clinics, and I'll be happy, Senator Dill, to provide you with his name and phone number if you'd like to have a telephone conversation with him.
Mr. Chair, members, Mike Pugliese, Deputy Commissioner, Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. You know, as a department, we certainly support anything that's going to help identify early the problems that our veterans are having when they're returning home. You know, one of the problems I have with the bill is that we don't have any experts here. And in my dealings and conversations with the federal VA, they've assured me that when developing the testing they're providing, they brought experts in the field to the table to develop these tests, not just that work for the Department of, you know, of Defense and for the VA, but also experts in the private sector that signed off on the testing procedures that they're doing. I'm not an expert in the field. I don't know if they're testing the right isotopes or not. But I think we need to determine whether or not that's the case. And I think we should at least be asking some experts to the table to take a look at what the VA is currently doing and saying, are they testing the right things? Are they not testing the right things? You know, the way this bill is structured, I think my department would have to work with the State Department of Health in determining a testing procedure. And in reaching out to the Department of Health, you know, there's not a tremendous lot of experience over there on something like this, and they would rely on some others. And, you know, some of the preliminary conversations I had said that we probably would do similar testing. So, you know, I think there's a lot of questions that need to be answered first. Is the testing that's currently being done by the VA appropriate, adequate? If so, then I don't see that there's a need, because there's a federal registry that was created to monitor veterans over many years to determine if there is an issue. They can go and ask for this test anytime. It doesn't have to be within the 2 years that they're eligible for free treatment. And if there are residuals as a result of their service, they can get treatment throughout their life, not just 2 years. And they can step forward at any time, self-identify, and say, I was in the Gulf, I was in Iraq, I was in Afghanistan. I think I may have been exposed. There's a survey that you take that determines whether or not you're going to go into the registry. I haven't heard of any veteran that's self-identified that's been kept from entering into the registry, that's been denied treatment or the test that Baltimore is providing. Like I said, I'm not an expert. I don't know that the test they're doing is appropriate or the one that they should be doing, but I don't know for sure that anybody at the table does, and I think that's something that we should determine first.
Mr. Tracy, wouldn't it be nice if the federal government would step up to the plate here because if we pass this bill and just to test people, then we ought to offer them some kind of a treatment or something other than just scare the wits out of them, because that's the part that I'm nervous about. And I'm not so sure that the federal government's going to be ready to step up, because if we keep monkeying with Iran, we're going to have more people with uranium problems than we probably have these 3,500 National Guard people that are coming back here in a month or so.
Mr. Chair, you're exactly right, and the VA has not yet willingly accepted the fact that people that have been exposed to depleted uranium might have a condition as a result thereof. So they're not what they call service connecting issues related to it, which means tying it to their service so that they can receive ongoing care and treatment and compensation. So even, you know, one of my problems, another problem with the bill is if we identify that, okay, you were exposed, all right, then what? What do we do then? You know, are we going to provide treatment? What is that treatment? Are we going to compensate them on the state level? How so? You know, I'm willing to do all those things. But I think the first step is determining whether or not the testing that's being done by the VA is appropriate and is adequate. And I don't know that it is or it isn't at this point, but I think we need to get some experts to the table to make that decision.
Well, Mr. Pergrisi, when I pick up the paper and look at big government and they've got rats and mold and everything else in a veterans hospital that we're supposed to be taking care of, I wonder if they'll even look at a little bill like this. They got a lot of work to do to bring back our soldiers into those. That's a terrible place.
Mr. Chair,
it shouldn't have happened, but it's been happening over the years, and nothing ever got done. Now all at once people got excited because it hit the papers and the TV. Now all at once we're going to have to hurry up and get that fixed. And as much I'm sympathetic to this, but I'm trying to figure out where we're going to get money for the treatment, or if there is a treatment. Maybe I'm not a doctor, I'm a farmer. Is there a treatment? I'm not so sure. And maybe we don't know that. Something we need to look at.
Mr. Chair, members, I think you're exactly right that those are some of the questions that I think need to be answered first before we jump into something and dedicate resources that are somewhat limited. You know, I'm all for identifying and helping them. You know, if the federal government isn't going to do it, and they have failed us in the past, no doubt, especially our veterans. And if they're doing that again, let's prove it. Let's make sure that they're not providing the right test. And if that's the case, and we as a state want to take the lead and step up and provide the appropriate test to measure the right isotopes and identify them, I think that's great. I think at the very least they should know that they're at risk or that they have this problem, so maybe they can make informed decisions about procreating. But I don't know. I don't have the answers yet, and I don't know that anybody here has those answers yet. So to move forward on something like this, I'm a little reluctant to support.
Senator Skoy.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Puglisi. So I listened to the testimony about the different tests and how this test that's being proposed here is going to identify what the current test is not. And I'm listening to you talk about how you're not knowing what's the appropriate test and you don't have the knowledge. If this bill doesn't pass, what is the VA going to do during the coming year when these young men and women are coming home to find the answer? I mean, how are we going to know that this is or is not a problem if all we do is keep using the same tests that we've been using that's showing that it's not a problem? And what has the department got on the plans to analyze and assess whether we do need this or not?
Mr. Chair, Senator Skoy, I think what I would like to recommend is that, you know, let's bring in some experts to take a look at the federal testing system and determine, you know, an independent expert or experts in the field that can say their testing that they're providing isn't adequate. And if that's the case, recommend what we as a state can do. Right now, without having the knowledge, we're assuming that they're testing the right things. They're telling us they've brought experts in the field in to create this test and to make sure they're providing the right test. We're taking their word on it. So what we're doing is making sure that as veterans return home since the first Gulf War, if they feel that they might have an undiagnosed illness or were exposed to certain chemicals, depleted uranium, we make sure that they get to the VA, self-identify, take the study, and get into the registry so that they can be monitored over years. Some of them are participating, as Ms. Gertner mentioned, an individual, Mr. Marshall, is involved in that, through Baltimore, where they're following up with the testing to determine long-term possible effects, if there are any. Right now, the reports are showing that there aren't any. I can't speak for the federal VA. I don't know that the tests are wrong, that they're right, that they're doing the right thing. Based on maybe some past history, maybe they're not. Maybe they should be suspect. But I think we need to bring experts in to take a look at what they're doing first before we assume it's wrong.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Bottolini has a response.
I find it kind of ironic. Let's trust what they're doing. I find that statement to be real strange. The nine soldiers from New York, the nine National Guard soldiers from New York who were experiencing multiple medical problems that were unexplained, the VA told them that it was mostly psychological problems that they were having. They were given the test by the VA, and they were told that they were not contaminated with depleted uranium. Once again, the New York News, or New York Daily News, paid for the testing of these nine soldiers that actually did the proper test, that actually isolated the isotopes, and four of those nine soldiers were contaminated with depleted uranium. The Baltimore study has also been kind of referred to here a couple times. The Baltimore study started in 1995 after the GAO came out with this report criticizing the military and their use of DU. The initial study, which lasted for the first 4 years, included 19 soldiers. 19 is how many they were studying. After 5 years, they increased that to 34 soldiers to try and get a study on the 500,000 soldiers that had served in Gulf War I. The study currently includes 134 soldiers out of the, I suppose, a million soldiers now, American soldiers, that have served in the Gulf War. I kind of wonder how meaningful any study is that is studying over a million people and has 134 people in the study. And besides that, the only people that are in this study are soldiers that actually have depleted uranium embedded in them. They have shrapnel from friendly fire that they did not remove. There's no question in my mind from the reading that I've done, from the studies that I've looked at, that this is a death sentence for these 134 people that are in that study. Once again, let's look back at Agent Orange. And the denial to this day, that the VA has towards the effects that had on the American soldiers. I believe it was only about 3 years ago that the Department of Defense finally admitted that there was a problem with the atomic veterans. These are the soldiers, the poor Slavs, who had to stand out in front of the atomic blast out on the New Mexico desert when they were testing it. 3 years ago, they finally admitted that these guys probably had a problem. If we wait for the federal government on this, these guys go by, day after day, with headaches that aren't explained, with other medical problems. They go to the VA. They're told it's all in your mind, it's psychological. There's nothing medically wrong with you. Is that fair? And even if there wasn't a treatment, wouldn't there be some comfort in knowing actually what was wrong with you, that it wasn't in your mind, that you weren't going crazy? I think they deserve that. And I think they're being denied it right now.
Senator Quibley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to address a question to Mr. Francis, if I could. Your testimony stated that that there was a proven test that detects exposure. Is that test widely accepted within the medical community as being specific for DU?
Again, I'm a chemist. I'm not a doctor or medical professional. In the reading that I've done on the reports, it is a sound test. I don't know whether it's generally accepted medical practice, but from a chemistry point of view, it's a test that's targeted for uranium-238.
All right. Well, Ms. Chair and Ms. Francis, it would seem to me that if we have a test that is targeted, I think, a lot of the scientific disciplines have a certain amount of overlap. It would seem to me, Mr. Chair, and to address Senator Dill's question on about the amount of money that we do here, it seems to me that if we invested $1 million in this process, we would then have a database that tells us whether or not it's a problem. If there is no problem in the people that come back that ask to receive the test and we don't get any positive readings, then we can assume that the feds are correct in saying that there is nothing to it. But if there is something there, if we do detect that they have had exposure, then we have a basis upon which to provide ongoing assistance.
Members, Senator Erickson Ropes, first I don't know what you're going to do with this bill yet, but we've already passed our budget. We've already wrapped it up. There's no way I can open that back up. We could do one or two things. And that's up to you to make that decision. We could table a bill and look for funding next year in a supplemental budget bill, or we can pass it out of here and refer to finance, but I'm afraid that might not get very far. Mm-hmm. I know the House has it over there. So we're kind of caught between I know all of us want to do something, but we don't, there's no way I can find that kind of money unless somebody knows where it is. So I would just, maybe we could, it wouldn't hurt if we studied this over and see what comes back from the new National Guard people that come back. But it's your bill, you do exactly what you want to do. But Senator Scoy.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And perhaps there is another option. I see that the House does have a bill moving that does have an appropriation, and perhaps they would be able to maintain that appropriation if we stripped out the appropriation language and let this bill move on. Maybe it could get resolved somewhere along the way as session comes to an end, rather than tabling it and indicating that we're not going to pass it. I think it's a concern. I think that Senator Kubley is right that they need to start developing a database of whether this is a issue or not. And the only way I can think to start that process is to start doing the testing, as the testifiers have indicated. And I know we're late on the finance bills. I don't know how this is here after we've passed all our finance bills before the Senate, but I think perhaps it might be an idea for Senator Erickson Ropes to consider is to strip out the section that's causing the financial problem, the appropriation, and see where it goes from there.
Senator Langsiff, do you have a question?
Well, Mr. Chair, nothing's cast in concrete around here. It kind of seems like if we send it to the Finance Committee, we should have some appropriation in there. And I was just wondering if we shouldn't just put $1 million in there and send it over there and see what happens. I have an idea a few days in the future we're going to be regrouping anyway.
on that point?
Senator Dale.
Mr. Chairman, members, on the point of putting some money in this bill and moving it on, I'm just wondering if somebody at the front desk or table could tell me a little bit more about the cost. The way I read this letter from David Francis, $1 million would buy 1,000 tests. But is there a situation where if you, you know, do 100 tests, it costs a lot more per test, and you get geared up and you do 1,000 tests, and maybe? Well, does it each test specifically cost $1,000? Period, or
it's approximately $1,200 per test.
Well, what's that for?
It takes a urine sample, and once again, it actually measures the uranium in the urine, and it actually isolates the individual isotopes. And naturally occurring uranium, U-238, the depleted part, is approximately 99.7100% of uranium. When they isolate the isotopes, if the reading comes back, let's say it comes back for the U-238 isotope at 99.72, it's imbalanced now. It's not naturally your background uranium. And if it's imbalanced, you know that you have heavy metal toxicity, that you have poisoning. I couldn't even begin to explain to you how the test is done, except for I've been told by a doctor that his lab does this test in Germany, that it's extremely complicated and time-consuming. How they do it, I mean, mm-hmm. I wouldn't even begin to guess.
Well, the question I would have has to do with the chemicals necessary to do the test, and or are you sending all this stuff to some lab and they're charging you $1,200 a test and that's the way it is, or is there some way to?
That's the current economics. Like Senator, any economic decision, you send it out for bid. You look for competitive bids, and already there's talk about other labs who can possibly do the test for less money. So, and then, as you mentioned, a volume discount on a number of tests. So there are economies of scale here that could be taken advantage of.
Senator Richard Ropes, I got a fourth
possibility.
Alternative. Maybe we should go on page 2, drop the $3 million, put $1 million in there, as Senator Langseff suggested. We'll send it off to finance, if that's the wishes of this committee, and then we'll see what happens between us rather than just think about that. But Senator Gimsey, Engelbretson, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's kind of where I'm at. I don't think we should be waiting around here for another year. I mean, this finance thing and this, what little I know and a few of us at the end of the table know about financing going on from here on out, there should be some dollars out there that can be put towards this. And we are the first, as the lady explained earlier, I think that would be something that this group could be known for, and I'd be very proud of being part of that. So I think we should just throw it at the finance folks and see if we can't come up with some money and get going on this. And even if it's only 1,000 of our troops, at least we got to start.
Well, Senator Engelbretson, if Senator Robes would change that 3-1.
I think that's a great idea, Mr. Chair.
With the understanding that there's going to be a new bunch of people coming back here, soldiers. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what they're going to get exposed to. I didn't know anything about dust until I picked up on that right away. But, you know, Iran is upset with the United States, and we're getting closer in time in Afghanistan. And whether you agree it's war or not, that's beside the point. But those veterans are going to come back, maybe exposed. So, Senator Robes, what would you like to do?
Mr. Chair, I would be very happy to drop it back from $3 million to $1 million and refer to finance and see what they have to say. And I agree with you, Senator Vickerman. No matter what you think about the war or the future wars or past wars, the fact is we have veterans that come back. We have injured men and women from our hometowns that come back, and unfortunately they're falling through the federal cracks. And that means the state has to pick up a lot of slack. And we have a lot of work to do ahead of us in terms of brain trauma. We're not prepared for the number of troops coming back with traumatic brain injuries. I mean, there's a whole list of things, and Maybe, Senator Vickerman, you'd like to consider another resolution, although you don't like resolutions, that maybe we need to just encourage the federal government, if they're going to have a war plan, that they also need to have a returning vets plan. Because right now they're coming back to no federal resources and very few state resources. We have to have a way to be able to not only reintegrate veterans back into our communities in terms of their jobs and families, but we have to be able to take care of them. And right now there doesn't seem to be a federal plan, and it lands on the state's plate. So I'm sad to bring this to you today, but I think it's the right thing to do for our vets.
On Senator Erickson Robe's motion on page 2, line 2.11, change the $3 million to $1 million. Does everybody understand that? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So adopted. No, Senator Robes, if we move this bill along, sometimes that's what it takes to wake up big government. Minnesota's been a leader most of the time, so.
I'd move Senate File 1397 as amended be passed and forwarded to Finance.
Senator Robes, Erickson Robes moves that Senate File number 1397 as amended be written and passed and be referred to Finance. Is there any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
And members, we are adjourned.
Margaret Bessel.
Oh, okay.